Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Yesterday, a press conference for the ages. That's what some are calling it, President Trump versus the media. Traffic deaths are up in the U.S. We'll tell you why. J is for Jihad, how the Islamic State indoctrinates children with math, grammar, tanks, and guns. We've got that story and more about sanctuary cities. Plenty of other info coming up this weekend edition of Trumpet Radio Live 101.3 KPCG.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG. We are online at kpcg.fm. And we have a live link also at thetrumpet.com. This is the weekend edition of Trumpet Radio Live. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon here today as well. Grant, did you, well, I guess you can't ignore it. You couldn't hide from it. The big press conference yesterday.
Yeah, I saw a bit of it. It was quite amusing to me.
It was all over the place. President Trump, of course, had a press conference, and the media was, well, I'm going to go out on a limb here. They don't like him. That's what I'm going to say.
That's what it seems like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're right there.
They're not a fan, if you will. CNN, they say this, but alone on the stage Thursday, which is typical for a press conference, gesturing behind his podium and locked in combat with reporters. He was in his element, they say, ensuring the event will go down as one of the most memorable presidential news conferences in history so far. It's going to be a battle royale between the Trump administration and the press, I would think, for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it seems like it. Every time Mr. Trump does anything, they attack him. And so he has attacked them pretty relentlessly, probably more than he even needs to. But at the same time, they deserve a lot of it.
It's kind of interesting. I was thinking about the press conference yesterday, and then I was thinking back to President Obama's last press conference, where it was, you know, good times all around. And the attitude that the press comes in with is completely different. They were in awe of President Obama. I mean, they wanted to be his buddy. They would do anything for that guy. They don't like this new guy, mainly because he's just not their buddy, I think. You know, he has some different maybe thoughts on a few things. But I think he was not a bandwagon supporter of President Obama, and that's why they're mad. But if you look at President Obama's last press conference, you can go through the transcript on the New York Times. The press laughed 11 times. You know, he'd make a joke and laughing and you know, yucking it up, and yeah, a couple of questions that maybe were a little more serious, but they never probed deeply into them. You know, how do you feel about this? He'd tell them, okay, move on. Yesterday, the press laughed one time, and they were laughing at the president pretty clearly. So now, I'm not saying that's some huge, you know, thing, but it does show a different attitude. One's jovial, we're all buddies. The other one is very hostile, and the press is very hostile.
That does seem to unveil a lot of shallowness in the media, how they just they want to be buddy-buddy with people. One woman at that last Obama press conference even made the call me symbol with her hand, which is just completely unprofessional. She's clearly not there to do her job. She's there to fawn over an idol, basically.
Yeah, that they didn't make that gesture back when George Washington was president. They didn't know what it meant. What are you doing with your hands? Call me. With what? What are you talking about? A different time.
We've evolved.
Yeah, I think the last administration probably did a lot to lower the dignity of the office quite a bit. Stuff like that, colloquialisms and, you know, just acting sort of undignified, going on talk shows, having dance-offs, things like that. And then the media loved it. They thought it was great. But I just think that's a little below the standard of what the office should be.
Yeah, Obama got into that habit of putting the mic out in front of him and then just dropping it
right
on the ground and walking off.
Which is a hip-hop rap, you know, type of thing. So, yeah, it is a very different feeling there in Washington, very different feeling with the press. And You know, if you look at some of what President Trump said yesterday, he did go after them pretty hard. And he said, you know, people, well, here's the exact quote. He said, "The press, the public doesn't believe you people anymore. Now, maybe I had something to do with that. I don't know. But they don't believe you. If you were straight and really told it like it is, as Howard Cosell used to say." And at least half the country, I think, just based on poll numbers, do not believe the press.
That's pretty sad for them, and they are still not backing down from a lot of the stances that they have stubbornly taken. In fact, a lot of the time, it's pretty easy now to see on any channel reporters or pundits almost crying over Mr. Trump's treatment of them, as if they're vulnerable somehow. They asked for this war, and now they're getting it, and they're weeping on national television because of it.
Yeah, it's a really interesting time. So we'll see how these press conferences develop in the future. I thought, and I didn't see the whole thing, but I did see one part where President Trump, I thought, made a probably a pretty good point, saying that, you know, in Russia, you've got Vladimir Putin sitting there watching, saying, "Oh, okay," or other world leaders, and saying, "It's not. It's going to be hard for this president to do a lot because the media is against him," mm-hmm. and they're actually undercutting his leverage with other nations. And I think that's probably true.
That probably is. Mr. Trump is there to do a job and not make friends with all of those people. That's really the bottom line. And it doesn't seem like the media is necessarily a big fan of that. And obviously, he doesn't share their dystopian worldview of somehow all the nations coexisting peaceably, there never being war again, making friends out of all of our enemies. Mr. Trump doesn't believe that's realistic. And in fact, it is not realistic. And they don't like being jolted back to reality like that.
Yeah, I guess not. It is interesting. I saw a little bit of a headline on Huffington Post. And Huffington Post obviously is very far left, very radical left. But just really a shabby headline. It said something like, "What happens when the president doesn't like to read?" And they went in there and they said that President Obama was like the greatest reader of all time, basically. And the new one, you know, he doesn't read stuff. I'm like, neither, nothing about it was factual or accurate. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And they gave an example of the past president reading like a sci-fi series. I'm like, so what? What does that have to do with anything?
Ugh, yeah. They also constantly praise Mr. Obama for being one of the greatest writers they've ever seen. And I read a detailed article proving how basically he had people write those things for him. And when he actually did write things, like in college, the subjects and verbs didn't agree. He didn't have a very good understanding of the language. But don't mind all that. Yeah. Let's just say he's one of the greatest writers of all time.
Right, and that's, I think that's what frustrates people. I mean, if somebody's a good writer, well, great, that's no problem. Or if they like to read, that's awesome. But it's just the media fabrication that one person is the greatest that man has ever seen, and the other one is the worst. Mm. Neither one are true. And it's just such a ridiculous narrative, and I think a lot of people are just getting tired of it.
Yeah, media has described Mr. Obama as someone with the morality on the level of George Washington, the wisdom on the level of Abraham Lincoln, Right. Just hyperbole to the absolute extreme. It's no wonder why people just don't believe what they say anymore.
Yeah, just like was mentioned yesterday in the press conference, just call it like it is. Call it down the line. I think people would appreciate that. Well, 2016 saw a jump in traffic deaths here in the U.S., the highest level in nearly a decade. Fatalities rose 6% in 2016, reaching an estimated 40,200 deaths compared to 3,757 from the year before. That's the first time since 2007 we've been over 40,000 fatalities. So it has jumped up, and it's amazing. I mean, it is a dangerous activity driving around.
Yeah, it's basically driving around your own weapon if you're not careful about it. And now it's not too hard to see, even just in general being on the road, that a lot of people just aren't taking the caution that is needed.
Yeah. Oh, I drove by a lady this morning who was on her phone. I mean, not even remotely looking at the road. And thankfully, we didn't collide. But it says the increase came as Americans drove more than last year. So more people driving, more accidents. That makes sense, I guess. 3% increase in total miles driven. The council cited continual gasoline prices, lower gasoline prices, as the improving economy as key factors. So the number was high right before the economic crash in 2008, and then the fatality number dropped a bit. But a lot of that had to do with people not driving as much. Mm-hmm. Gas was more expensive. There was economic problems, so less driving, less accidents, I guess, goes hand in hand. In the last 3 years, 13 states have raised speed limits on at least some portion of their interstate highways. So I guess that's good to a point. But at some point, I guess, how high can you go? Make it the Autobahn. I guess. Just do whatever you want.
Yeah, and there's a big issue sometimes with if there are bad weather conditions, people still trying to go the speed limit when clearly you should go 15, 20 miles slower probably. But I always see people trying to go 75 through a charging rainstorm somehow.
Yeah. I mean, most accidents are, because of negligence of some kind. Driving too fast, driving too close, not paying attention. They say, additionally, driver distraction and our society's addiction to electronic devices is likely playing a role in the increase in deaths. No surprise. If you're on your phone or other device, you're not paying attention to the road usually.
That's a really good point. And it's obviously, like you said, pretty much everyone does it without even trying to hide it anymore, even though now it's just finally become illegal in Oklahoma to text and drive. Still, people are just doing it. They're holding it up there, like way in front of the steering wheel. It's obvious to everyone driving by what they're doing.
And it's amazing how much further we go than we realize. You know, you think, I'm just going to look down for a second. Well, but if you're going 60 miles an hour, you travel quite a distance. And so we probably have all had those moments where I wasn't paying attention like I should. They say the estimated annual mileage death rate last year was 1.25 deaths per 100 million vehicle miles, which is an increase of 3% from 2015. Teens also have the highest fatal crash rates, are driving more now too because the economy is better. So the teens, come on, teens.
They're actually, a lot of companies are changing some of the technology in their cars because basically they'll have like a red key that will turn the ignition for the teenage driver, and then it will like track how they're driving. There's different apps for that too, but it is pretty important, especially when they're first starting out. There's a lot of rules to remember, and it's just really unfamiliar. I actually was with my brother the first time he drove out of our neighborhood, so that was pretty interesting. We did get pulled over the very first time he was driving, but other than that, he actually did a pretty good job.
Well, yeah, and when I was a teenager, I knew that teens had a bad rep when it came to driving, and a lot of things, actually. But the thing is, there are responsible teenagers, and it's too bad that kind of the overall thought of maybe they're being irresponsible, it ruins it for the good ones. And like for me, I had to get a job and pay for my license, pay for my car. And when you have to pay for it yourself, you are more careful with it, I think, anyway, because if I were to get in an accident, that's it. That's my car, and I paid for it. And I think if you're made to be responsible, then you do pay more attention. I know I did when I drove as a teenager.
Absolutely. That's a really good point, too. A lot of teenagers maybe don't have to pay for it, and they just feel like it's kind of just a casual privilege, not really something that they have to earn in any way, just something that falls into their lap. I know, like, even like you were saying about teens having to get charged a little bit more, even men my age have to get charged more. I don't get in any wrecks. I don't break the rules of the road, but it's just kind of how it goes. They just have to charge people more depending on what the majority of those types of people do.
Well, you're driving that Lamborghini too, so
yeah,
they're gonna charge you more for that.
I'm always just automatically speeding in that thing.
Well, the guy does have a Lamborghini. I'm just kidding, he doesn't have one, but
mine's the worst car in the lot.
I wouldn't go that far, but
well,
yeah.
I don't know which one's worse.
I suppose we'll have to take pictures of everyone's cars and we'll rate them, you know, least to best, best to least. But yeah, sometimes you'll see teenagers driving like trucks, pickups that are really high with huge wheels. And I just think, I don't think you really need that. That's a dangerous vehicle.
Yeah, they don't need to be in the vehicle that's going to win in a crash when they're often going to be the cause of the crash. Probably don't deserve to win the crash, too.
There was of course, you know, everybody, you turn 16, everybody starts getting their license and their cars. Sometimes, I mean, depending on their situation. I remember a girl driving to high school, and she had, this monster truck, basically. And it was huge tires. I mean, just ridiculous. And, you know, it was pushed way up. And we were on the bus, because I didn't have my license yet, and she was driving the other way, and I saw her drive in the morning over the top of somebody else's car, just the hood. A woman driving the other way. She didn't see her. She pulled out in front of her and drove over the top. Didn't hurt her, thankfully. She hit the brakes, the lady coming the other way. But, you know, crushed the front of the car, broke the windows out. I never saw the girl driving that truck again. But I thought, she should not be driving that vehicle. She almost flipped it over, too.
See? I mean, it's like those things are indestructible on the road. They're going to get the better of every crash, and so maybe a teenager shouldn't be driving
them. Honda Civic.
Yeah.
Right? Something like that? Yeah,
Honda Civic. A little bit more careful in a bit of a more vulnerable car, too.
Yeah, it's a status symbol when you're going to school to have something that's kind of, I don't know, fast and flashy and big and loud. And I've never understood why people want really loud vehicles. I'm sure those that like them, you know, they have a specific reason. But they put like mufflers on that are modified to make it louder than it needs to be. And they'll drive by you in town, and I just find it very loud and irritating. Who'd want to drive? At first, you think their muffler's gone, and then you're like, oh, no, they bought a specific muffler to be really loud.
Yeah, and it's almost like it's a lack of privacy, too. You couldn't go out at night without the whole neighborhood waking up to your car turning on and driving off. It seems like you'd want to be a little bit more anonymous when you come and go.
Maybe that's why they did. Maybe the parents said, we don't want them sneaking around.
Oh, I see. Actually pretty smart, then.
We're going to put that really loud. Our motorcycles are that way, too. Mm-hmm. They're just super, super loud. And the people driving them must wear earplugs or something.
Yeah, and it's almost like, look at me whenever you're driving it. I wouldn't want everyone to be looking at me personally.
No. Yeah, I think that mentality changes. When you're younger, you do want people to look at you. And then when you're older, you're like, nah, pay no attention.
I'm not even here.
Just quietly drive my Honda Accord over here. Los Angeles, there's some problems there. Occasionally, this happened at a school. Parents speak out after wild fight at Grover Cleveland High in Reseda. They had a gang fight that was caught on tape, and a security guard was reportedly beaten during the Wednesday fight that occurred around 11 a.m. on the campus. That's right around lunchtime. Kids getting hungry, have a gang fight. And after the brawl, the school was placed on lockdown. Parents received a recorded phone call from the principal saying our campus was briefly in lockdown, and then they moved on. Some parents are upset. They feel like more should have been done. Some of the students that were there said that they didn't think the security guards and police were intervened fast enough. They let the fight go on for a while. So some debate there about what to do. But times are different than they used to be. You can't get involved in those fights if you're an adult.
Yeah, a lot of the time you get charged criminally if you put a stop to it in any decisive kind of a way, because it's like you're assaulting a minor. Some helpless little child. No, it's a gang member who happens to be 1 year younger than the age of an adult.
You ever seen any big fights in school?
Not really. I was never really in the areas where those things would happen, so I kind of stayed out of that for the most part.
Yeah, we didn't have anything on the level of this. I don't think we had any gangs.
No.
I think some kids were pretending to be in gangs, but I don't think they really were. Which sometimes they're more dangerous, but there were fights that would happen in middle school and high school occasionally, and But then, I mean, teachers would jump in pretty quick. They'd end it. They'd grab the kid and haul him off. But now I don't think he can do that as much.
Yeah, anytime you lay a finger on a child now, it's like it's child abuse.
Yep.
Call human services, get the teacher fired forever.
For the most part, the guys that were it was usually guys, girls occasionally, but the guys in particular, they were pretty big boys. Mm. They were full grown. So mentally not, but physically they were. And you'd have to... You know, you'd have to be a pretty big guy yourself to get in there and break some of those up, from what I recall.
Yeah, and there are some videos. That's the problem. There are some videos of teachers in the classroom dealing with rebellious kids the way that they need to be treated. And obviously, there's always someone to pull out a phone and videotape it,
yep.
Which gets them in a lot of trouble. So really, do you want to step in there? It's kind of the same situation with the police, where if they're filmed all the time or if they're scrutinized all the time, then they're less likely to step in, just like in this case, too. The police were blamed for not stepping in fast enough.
Right. I mean, can you imagine going down there as an officer? You'd think, oh, great. We got to handle this really carefully because everyone's going to film it. If we in any way push somebody or bump them, you know, now we're going to have problems. We're going to have lawsuits. We're going to have riots. So you can't attack the police and then expect them to protect you all the time either.
Yeah. That's, can't have it both ways. You have to choose one or the other. Either everyone defends themselves all the time or the police have to be allowed to do their jobs to the fullest.
The police said this was a fight here at this California high school because they were rival gangs. The school system says they are not rival gangs. They get along? They're gangs that get along?
Well, they just fought, so maybe they are rivals now.
My guess would be there's probably some of that going on. So, yeah, unfortunate. And, you know, if you've gone to a bigger public high school, there are some days that are a little nerve-wracking. especially if you know a fight's coming your way. Hopefully not personally, but there's a certain buzz in the hall. You know something's about to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if only the students would get that excited about what they're learning in class. Like, the most energy you ever see at a school is if there's a fight that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And pretty much everyone knows all day. I wouldn't be surprised if, like, half the teachers knew as well, but, you know, it's kind of hard to stop it sometimes.
In middle school, we had us sports fields behind the school, and then there was, like, a pine forest behind that called the Pines.
Ooh.
That's where it went down. After school.
We had something like that, too, actually.
We're going to fight in the Pines.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you don't want to go to the Pines. There's trouble. There's trouble in the Pines. Squirrels just watching it all. What's
ready
going
to attack.
Yeah. And so, I do remember one fight. I didn't see it, but the whole crowd starts moving. You know, like, things are happening. So, everyone goes upstairs because this is where the fight is, and it was over quick. But there was, I remember, blood just all the way down the hallway.
Wow.
It got finished pretty fast, but guy did some damage.
Oh, terrible.
So, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, and you're, I don't know what I was at the time. I was probably, well, let's see, I probably would have been like 13. So that kind of, you know, it makes you a little nervous. You don't walk around looking at everybody in a confrontational way, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's, in a way, it's a good jolt of reality to realize that you can't necessarily puff your chest out too much. You can't think you're more than you are, or else someone's going to make you prove it.
Yeah. If you're looking for a lot of attention, you'll find it.
In a very bad way.
And you don't
very
want
painful way.
You don't want that. So that's unfortunate when those things happen, but they do happen. And that was really my experiences were pre guns. You know, people didn't bring guns to school. Now it's more common.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now they have to have metal detectors in a lot of schools to try and stop that. At least in the good old days, they used to engage in fisticuffs only. They'd limit it at least at that.
It was good old fist fights, and then occasionally somebody would try karate.
Yeah.
But it never worked because no one knew karate. You ever notice that in movies? No matter what power, like if it's aliens fighting or whatever, it always comes down to karate in some fashion.
Yeah, it does.
They always are karate kicking each other. I've noticed that. Like, no matter, they could have like all these supernatural powers and they're still having a karate fight.
Yeah, they could blast each other away from distance, but they decide to go into close combat for whatever reason. It doesn't seem to make a whole lot of logical sense.
Yeah, that's all we can think of is karate. That's like the ultimate form of battle. But I remember one time actually in high school, most people were past fighting in high school. There was always a few that would get into it, but not too many. And most people were kind of getting on with life. And of course, you get to be 18, you can get in some serious trouble. It's not just suspensions now, and now it's more. But we were coming back from lunch one day, and we walked through this. We had a field house and then just a regular gym. We were walking through the gym to head to a hallway, and there's these two guys up on stage. They didn't think anybody was in there, and they were trying to karate fight each other, but neither of them knew karate. They were, like, training. We just stopped and watched them for a while. You know, it's like where you jump around, you try to kick, but your foot never gets, like, a foot off the ground. So I don't know what they were training for, but...
Well, if they had some kind of a special training, they could defend themselves from bullies a little bit better. Instead of just brawling, they'd have some sort of technique at least.
Yeah, well, I guess it was funnier to us because knowing who these people were, they were kind of the bottom rung in a way.
Yeah.
And they tried to form a gang, but nobody took them seriously. I think it was something generic like the Dragons or something, you know.
And that fits in with karate too,
right? And I think they were training, you know. And we're just like, really? We're all like 17, you know. But
oh, come on,
the Dragons. I wonder whatever happened to them. this is a sad story, but it was strange. This happened in a zoo, I think over in Europe, in Germany somewhere. A penguin got stolen from the zoo, and they found it dead in the parking lot.
Oh, sad.
Who would do that?
That's just kind of pointless.
Everybody loves to go to the zoo and look at the animals. And penguins, they're just fun to look at. And so, the worst part of it is, it was beheaded. Somebody beheaded
the
penguin, threw it in the parking lot.
Just no point. There's,
no.
They could have sold it. They could have tried to keep it as a pet. Anything worthwhile, at least, and they had to kill it and leave it there. That probably scarred some kids.
That's a terrible. That makes me mad.
Yeah.
Because who are penguins hurting?
Yeah, they're just sitting there.
They're great. They're great little creatures. They say the desperate search for a young penguin apparently stolen from a zoo in Germany reached a horrifying end Thursday, and of course they found the bird out there in the parking lot. The Humboldt penguin vanished last Saturday from the Lusen Park in Mannheim. Officials there said all signs pointed to theft. There was no indication of the flightless bird escaping or being attacked by a wild animal. I wonder how they got in there and got him.
Yeah, that's a tough situation to figure out. It seems like also, with that being in Germany, I hope that's not like some sort of a message being sent, you know?
Well, you know, probably, yeah, probably isn't, but I had the same thought. Like,
yeah.
What, well, you know, why would that be, why would it be done in that way? It just seems weird to me, but.
Yeah, most people who want to kill something usually do not behead it, so that's kind of makes me think of ISIS, which, yeah. You know, they've been attacking in Germany a lot. I don't know if that has any correlation at all.
No, I don't, yeah, it's interesting. I had sort of a similar thought. It's just a weird way to go about doing something like that, but unfortunate. That's a sad event. This one's a little better. What is the secret to a long life? What is one secret anyway? This is from the Daily Mail. A spunky New York City woman who turned 100 says love led to a long life.
Well, that's how a lot of people stay alive so long, and then they die as soon as their partner dies.
That's true. Her name is Caridad McKeever. She turned 100 yesterday, on Thursday. So the secret to a long life is love and finding... Now, this is her quote here. The secret to a long life is love and finding a big man who you can rest on at night. So take that for what it's worth, ladies. I don't know what we're supposed to do as gentlemen, but...
Yeah, it's really not fair.
No. She says, it's love that got me here. She was having a birthday get-together at the nursing home. She says, I like big men. They are sweeter, more passionate, and patient. But her definition of big, I don't know. Her husband, who died in 1986, he was a World War II veteran. He won several medals of honor, or several medals. He was 6 feet tall, 185 pounds. So, I mean, it's big. It's not that big.
Big for probably back then, a little bit more so. And now we've all kind of, we've expanded, it seems like. But he's also, it seems like, big in character, too, to win medals like that.
Yeah.
He was a heroic gentleman.
So she likes big guys. When, you know, people get older, a lot of times they don't care. They just tell you what they think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had an experience that reminded me of this story. When I was in high school, we took a field trip to a nursing home. And I don't even remember really why we went there, but it might have been a health class or something. So there's older people sitting around, you know, they're probably kind of bored. And they see all these high school kids come in. So, okay. So this older guy kind of waves me over, come here. You know, he wants to give me some life advice. So I'm like, all right. So I go over there and he's like, he said, listen, this is what you do. You get yourself a big girl, get her out on the dance floor, and you get her spinning. And you just hold on and enjoy the ride. That's what he told me. I was like, okay.
You try it?
no, I don't think that's occurred. But I have to be careful because I don't want to call my wife, you know, big. She's normally sized human being. yeah, he had some interesting information. So he said, yeah, just enjoy the ride.
I like it.
Yeah.
It sounds like good advice to me.
I don't know if that's insensitive advice or, you know, if that fits into today's politically correct wording, but that's what he told me. So.
Hey, all things are equal here. The woman said she likes big men and the man said he likes big women. So I think we should all be able to say that.
Yeah. That, you know, see, you get, that's another good reason to spend some time talking to some of the older people, because they'll give you the unfiltered truth, at least as they see it.
Yeah. Well, they don't have any, like, political games to play anymore when they're that old.
That's right.
That's what I like about them.
Yeah. He also, he told me one other thing, which, I don't know. He said, look, in the wintertime, you want a bigger girl because you stay warmer.
Right.
Summertime, you go a little smaller.
Oh, so he's a promiscuous old man, huh?
Yeah, so, you know, hopefully it doesn't offend anybody. That's what the older man told me at the nursing home. So I didn't take him up on it. I just listened respectfully, and I said, okay. So
he had ladies for all the seasons.
Yeah, well,
they all agreed to it somehow.
Yeah, apparently. I mean, he picked me out. Like, he looked at the crowd. He's like, that guy. I'm going to impart this to that guy. So I don't know. I don't know why he picked me, but
it looked like he needed lady help.
Maybe that's what it was. That guy looks like he could use some help. I'll tell him my two secrets. He was all about sizing.
That's hilarious. Nothing about looks, just like however large they are.
Yeah,
it's very important.
He didn't define that, like what he meant. I didn't ask. Key David program's coming up here on KPCG in a bit. A brand new program this weekend. Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. And you can watch that online at thetrumpet.com. Also, it'll be on television. You can check the trumpet.com for your local listings. Germany has been a close friend of America for decades. With the surge in German nationalism, their friendship is about to change. Brand new and really important program. check that out at thetrumpet.com. Okay, Grant, you've got a story for us here. This is from the New York Times opinion piece. It's all opinion, isn't it?
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of logic in this one.
The title is Sanctuary Cities in Name Only. They want these cities to step up what they're doing.
They need to go even further than they've already gone, which is letting people stay here illegally and in many cases flaunt it. Basically, let it be known to everyone that they are not even supposed to be in the country right now. They want the cities to go even further than just disagreeing with the federal government when it comes to immigration enforcement. They actually want them to just stop arresting people for low-level crimes because right. a lot of them would be illegal. That would get them in the federal system and give them a chance to be found by the federal government.
Yeah, and from what I read about it, they were saying, oh, they shouldn't bother people if they're littering or if they're doing this whole list of things. And I thought, would you want to live on a street where people just threw stuff out in the street and did the other quote-unquote low-level crimes? I wouldn't.
No.
I'd say, hey, can you keep the neighborhood clean? You know, you don't want people just chucking stuff out. And they don't think that's a big deal. Let that ride.
Exactly. They're trying to at least make it like a small fine instead of charging it as an offense. So I guess they don't want to take away the punishment entirely. But still, they tried to claim that punishing low-level offenses doesn't actually prevent larger offenses from taking place, which that is very untrue.
Right.
We've seen that in New York City under Rudy Giuliani. Preemptive policing worked very well. The crime plummeted under him because he was searching guys who were hanging around the wrong areas instead of just letting them do that and then end up shooting someone later on in the night.
Absolutely, because people that are going to commit crimes, they have a certain attitude usually about it, where they don't care about following rules, and they're going to break them on a low level, and they're going to break them on a high level.
Yeah.
What do you do as a parent if your kids are, you know, they have a wrong attitude and they're causing problems on a low level? You better deal with it then, because the high level is coming, and then what are you going to do? So they need to do that with a criminal. And they are criminals because they're illegally here.
Right.
I think they're trying to blur the line between legal immigrants and illegal. They're not the same. It's two different things.
That's really what the issue is, and they're pretty proud of the New York City mayor, who I think is actually an open socialist, but he's saying that we embrace diversity and we are a city of immigrants. That's true, but why mix the illegals with the legal ones? A lot of the legal ones would be upset that all the illegal ones could save time in terms of years and thousands of dollars by just coming here the wrong way.
Right, that's the thing. Whenever they want to have a counterpoint to, say, cracking down on illegal immigration, they want to talk about the positive things that immigrants do, and that's fine. But legal ones, not illegal, that's the difference. They're not all the same. If a group comes here legally, that's awesome. This is not what that is, but they're trying to blur it all together like it's one thing.
Yeah, these are basically the consequences of lawlessness. They're saying, well, you're already a sanctuary city. You're already refusing to comply with the federal government. You're refusing to help the federal government arrest these people whenever they shouldn't be here in the first place. And even in some cases, you're overlooking some small crimes and refusing to report those to the federal government. But now let's just go even further and negate all of these small crimes, because we know that a lot of illegals are going to be doing that. Yeah, they are going to be doing that because they came here illegally in the first place, so they wouldn't have too much problem breaking other laws while they're here.
Well, you know, it's so funny that this New York Times opinion piece is encouraging the cities to do what the illegal immigrants are doing.
Yeah.
Which is, hey, you already broke some laws. Why don't you break the rest of them?
Mm-hmm.
They're encouraging them to do the exact same thing.
It's just a horrible line of reasoning, and that just shows you why Mr. Trump is being so strict about cleaning it up as it is. He's already, I guess this article would describe it as, rounded up 600 illegals in 11 states. Striking fear in the immigrant communities, this article says.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's not striking fear in any of the law-abiding legal immigrants. It's striking fear in those who know they shouldn't be here and have basically flaunted the fact that they're breaking the law. Now they know that they're going to be held accountable for that.
You know, it's crazy. They feel free, this opinion writer, to tell cities to break the law in a national paper. I was like, where else can you do that? Can you openly go around encouraging people to break the law and not be penalized for that? Can you go around telling people, hey, call me, I'll tell you how to cheat on your taxes?
Yeah, right.
Can you put an ad on TV for that? Is that okay?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, it's law. I mean, to publicly encourage people to break the law, how can that be legal?
Yeah, it is a frustrating thing to see so many radical leftists even have such a huge platform like this, like the New York Times, to be able to get their message out to millions of people. You know, probably about half of them will actually agree, too. That's a bit annoying. But it seems like illegal immigration is a huge issue on the minds of a lot of voters. They have a strong feeling either way in almost every case. And I think my experience with it, I was at a sporting event recently, and there was a huge Mexico chant that broke out in the crowd. There were a lot of Mexicans there, and they were proudly chanting Mexico. It's great to be proud of your own culture, but at the same time, why are you living here if you think Mexico is a better place? It's just pretty clear that a lot of them aren't assimilating. They're not happy to be American. They couldn't probably pass any basic American history test and become proud in the values that we stand for.
Yeah. Really strange. New York Times opinion piece. Sanctuary cities in name only, and they want to encourage them to now be more, to break the law even more so. I'm going to cancel my subscription in the New York Times. Oh, wait, no, I don't have one.
You don't even have one.
Does anybody, people don't have subscriptions like they used to. Now it's all online.
Yeah, I've had a couple basically magazine subscriptions. I don't usually get into the newspaper subscriptions unless they're like a local paper more so, but yeah. Yeah, like even I had a subscription to the Atlantic magazine, and then they made an official endorsement of Hillary Clinton when they hadn't endorsed anybody except for Abraham Lincoln and Lyndon Johnson in their history.
Wow.
They thought it was so important this time
right.
that they had to endorse Hillary Clinton, which made me unsubscribe.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the only time I've ever had a magazine subscription lately is if I have a few frequent flyer miles.
Yeah.
And you can't do anything else with them. They're like, hey, you want some magazines? I'm like, yeah, I guess so.
And there's usually like eight of them that they give you for free for a while.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
And they just pile up in the corner. This is Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, excuse me, and Abraham Blondeau here today. And you subscribe to Mounty Monthly, don't you? That's a Canadian... Canadian magazine?
You get it from birth in Canada.
it's a national, like, when you're born, you get your birth certificate and Mountie Monthly subscription.
It's an inheritance of all Canadians.
Yeah, so. that would actually, I wonder if there's a magazine like that. You should look and see.
Maybe. There aren't too many magazines. Actually, when I was traveling, I bought a magazine to read on the plane because I finished reading the book I brought. I bought.
Why'd you waste your time? Just get the Sky Mall magazine. It's a freebie.
It's amazing.
I read that in 5 minutes, though.
Take your time. You got to think about those purchases.
Savor it. Come on.
Well, because I already read it on the previous flight, because the same one, so I need something else. I was, I think I got Foreign Relations or Foreign Affairs, Foreign Affairs magazine, so that was pretty interesting. But I was looking through all the magazines they had, and I was like, I wouldn't want to buy one of those in an airport and then carry that on a plane with me.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Very few were, some of them weren't even inappropriate, but just the content and stuff. Like, I just wouldn't want other people seeing me reading that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because I think probably the only time I really sit down and read a magazine is on a plane, you know, if I happen to grab one. But, you know, sometimes depending on the article, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Usually I pick up a sports magazine or something like that. But you can get some pretty interesting ones, but it's just hard in your day-to-day life to sit down and say, I'm going to read this 9-page feature story on, you know, Aaron Rodgers or whoever I'm interested in.
And eventually you just use them to kill flies around the house, and then you can't put it on or put it on the coffee table.
Yeah.
The coffee table magazine.
Dual purpose.
Coffee table. Yeah.
Yeah, dual purpose. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So, that's New York Times opinion. Sanctuary City is a name only. Grant, thanks for bringing that to us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Abraham, you've got a story for us here from foreignpolicy.com. And this is kind of interesting. J is for Jihad, how the Islamic State indoctrinates children with math, grammar, tanks, and guns. They start them young.
Yeah, this is a really interesting article. I think it's pretty common knowledge that, for the most part, a lot of radical Islamic organizations have educational organizations. They're well-documented. But this article really brings out a really interesting one. And ironically, the author's name is Robbie Grammer.
You better have good grammar.
Yeah. But the Islamic State actually has created children's apps for phones, tablets. They've also written textbooks. They have PE manuals. They've even built schools in Syria. And what they're doing is they're not just learning about math, grammar, and English, the normal subjects. The way they learn them is actually indoctrination. And they, I really encourage the, if you're interested in learning more about this, to go look at the article, because they have pictures and examples, and it's really, well, disturbing. And
yeah, I saw the one, I think, the graphic in the beginning, and it was a something that kids really would be interested in. It looked like a kid's magazine or something, where it had colorful like rocket ships, and it had the Quran in the corner with like a little rainbow by it or something. And you know, as a kid, you'd be like, hey, that looks really interesting. Yeah, but you're talking about jihad.
Yeah, exactly. It goes, that one, it's a children's app, and they just swipe on your phone, learning the alphabet. And they have like A's for this, B's for that. but for B, they're all Arabic, so I won't venture there, because I don't even have an idea of where to start. But the B, they have a picture of an AK-47, the Arabic word. B is for gun. S is for sword, D is for tank. And they have like pictures of these things, and that's how kids learn the alphabet, is by associating them with those. And even they had some examples of textbooks, kids learning math problems and such. On one page they have in the article, it has some apples they have to count up and multiply, and pencils, and then across the page there's bullets and guns they have to add up, and they have watermarked guns in the background, the pages. It's all colorful and cartoonish, but it's that kids like. But it's teaching them to be familiar with those subjects.
Yeah, there's a book that I just read, Captive, by Jer Van Dyke, who was taken prisoner by the Taliban. And when he was there in his cell, I guess, where they held him, they'd make him listen to music. And it was men singing. I don't think there was any actual like instrumental music with it, but it was men singing, and they were just singing all these songs about jihad and dying and, you know, glory and all this. And they listened to it all the time. It really influenced their thinking. So similar for adults too.
Yeah, the whole culture over there is all created for that purpose. You can't get anything over there without having that kind of orientation on it. They even had a PE manual. It's called Physical Education for the Islamic State. And instead of learning about dodgeball, soccer, it teaches them about infantry tactics and small arms tactics and how to fight, how to have hand-to-hand combat with a knife, that sort of thing. So we're teaching these things to elementary school kids and up. And
this isn't like the fringe group. This is kind of more of a, you know, a lot of people are involved in this.
Yeah, exactly. This is... I mean, this is the Islamic State, probably the most dangerous terrorist organization at the moment. And as the author points out, this isn't unique to the Islamic State.
Right.
Hezbollah, Hamas, almost all the terrorist groups in Africa, the Taliban, they all have similar processes. The Islamic State is the one using technology the most, like making apps for this. But you can see it's not just a culture of killing. They're creating a culture to pass on to generation, to where even if, when we were talking about the book you read, even when you come into it and you're just exposed to it a little bit, it does affect you. So imagine growing up in it from a small child to an adult. It's almost impossible to unlearn all those things and not have scars or something like that affect you.
Yeah, the Jer Van Dyke here in the book Captive, I mean, he's in his 60s, and he grew up, what would be considered, I guess, Christian in the U.S. Pretty strong religious influence there. And he was in, I think they had him for about 40 days, give or take. And they were trying to convert him to Islam. And he keeps talking about how they would always say there's no compulsion in religion, but they were constantly making him, you know, if you want to live, you're going to convert. And so he would go through the at least the charade of it to try to stay alive. But it did really start to mess with his mind. That's a 60-year-old man doing it for 40 days. What about a kid from birth? It changes the way you think. It's not the way we think in the West, and you're not going to change their minds. at least not in the short term.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is something that you just can't fight with 2,000-pound bombs. It's a cultural thing. It's an idea you have to fight, and something that becomes embedded far beyond just a leader or a group of leaders. It's something that it can impact the whole area for years, generations, decades. And he has, at the end of the article, there's a great quote here, just talking about what this means for children in general. It's just a couple paragraphs here, quoting the author Robbie Grammer. And the investments pay off. Weinberger told Foreign Policy, once the Islamic State teaches young followers English, they can deploy not just to the front lines, but to meetings with criminal networks, to cities to recruit more fighters, and to the internet to bolster the group's online presence in the English-speaking world. But some are used for more gruesome tasks. The United Nations recorded 362 cases of child soldier recruitment in Syria in 2016 alone, of which 274 were attributed to the Islamic State. The terrorist group was reported to use children to carry out raids, engage in fights, and even execute enemies. But the path taken from child to executioner, experts say, all started in the classroom.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great quote showing, I mean, this might seem harmless or foolish maybe to us in the West when we're not really impacted by it directly, but that's how you create, that's how you get 8 to 12-year-olds be able to commit war atrocities. Is by starting them from birth up in that kind of culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I've mentioned this before, but I think it's a good point. The history of the Gulag in Russia, there were children born in that camp system that didn't have any parents, and so they were treated kind of like animals. They didn't have the love and the attention, the affection that a child normally would, and they were the most feared people in the camp because they didn't have normally developed human emotions. They would kill you for anything. And so the criminal element in those camps would get those kids, 10-year-olds, whatever they were, and say, you know, go kill that guy. And they would do it. And they would have no, they didn't care. They would do it for a piece of bread. It meant nothing to them because no one had taught them how to treat other people or to have a sense of, you know, compassion or something like that. I think we kind of assume falsely, a lot of people do, that, you know, man's just born with sort of this good heart and he'll, you know, figure it out. That's not the case. If you're not taught how to behave, then you don't know how to behave. Or in this case, if you're taught specifically to hate a group or to kill, they will. They're taught that. And so I think sometimes the West doesn't understand that.
Yeah, and I think that's very evident in the way in which we pursue our foreign policy and our strategy, especially with defeating ISIS. We think airstrikes, supporting certain nations in the fight against them, the very minimal involvement, it might stop terrorism in our own countries. But it doesn't solve the problem.
Right. If you knock off ISIS, which would be great, who pops up in their place?
Yeah.
It's the old whack-a-mole game.
Yeah.
When you hit one, another one comes up. And because the problem is what? It's ideology. People don't want to talk about that. They want to make it out like, you know, it's all love and peace, but it's not.
Yeah, exactly. And the only way to solve it is to introduce another idea that can replace that. You can't. Because a lot of these children, you may kill off the leaders and ISIS may go dormant. The Taliban will move on. Al-Qaeda will move on to a different manifestation of itself. But you have these children who you can't prosecute. You have no idea whether they're loyal or anything. They could grow up, become the next Zarqawi, the next Bin Laden. Mm-hmm. You just don't know.
And that highlights even the issue with illegal immigration. How do you know who's coming across the border? You don't know. If you're not vetting people, does anybody think that people, ISIS or whoever, teaching children to do this, they wouldn't send somebody across? You know, and on this side of it, they say, hey, they're a kid, they're a dreamer. Well, you don't know what they are, and they could be a stone cold killer.
Yeah, you don't know what kind of dreams they've been having.
Exactly, yeah. And so, again, you should take a look at who's coming because there are some really bad groups out there that are doing some pretty horrible things.
Yeah, actually, there's an article. Because the Islamic State is losing ground quite rapidly in Syria and Iraq, that some experts believe that when ISIS collapses as a national state or as an organization there, it will actually become more dangerous because all those fighters will liquidate all the children, the families, and they'll be sent to other countries to become terrorist cells or just to live there as to eventually they could commit. They could easily be radicalized or returned to that way of thinking, even if at that moment they're not, because of this kind of indoctrination they've been going over. And if that, and that's just ISIS. In the world at the moment, there's nearly a million child soldiers from Africa, Middle East, over to Afghanistan, different areas, of all different religions, different purposes, different wars that have been going on. And so now some of them aren't anti-Western, but when you have such a wide scope of these kind of activities going on, it's not far-fetched that, and we've had millions of immigrants move into Europe and such places from those areas. That's not too far-fetched to believe that you're gonna be dealing with these kind of children, these kind of people in those countries. And how do you combat that kind of education? And how do you deal with those people in your society when they already hate your way of life?
Yeah, it's the most despicable thing to use children in that way. But they're malleable, so they can form their thinking, and they'll be loyal in a lot of cases, and they look harmless. So it is the perfect weapon in a way, as terrible as it is. But they don't see it that way. I mean, even if you look at, again, going back to this book Captive here by Jerry Van Dyke, you know, he spent time with again, they were terrorists, they were Taliban, but still, I mean, they were tribal groups as well. And you know, they didn't see life the way we saw it. They kept telling them, nothing matters but the afterlife. Nothing matters. Do they totally believe that? I don't know, but that's what they preached anyway. And so the stuff that happened today, they didn't really care about in the same way. I mean, probably to a point they did, but they were pushing for the afterlife. So if you're a kid and you're being told, hey, you know, you've got to do this horrific thing, but it's good and you're supposed to, and then you're going to have all this great stuff afterwards, people believe that.
Yeah, I mean, if you were a child or a young man living in those countries, poor, don't really have too much going for you, and they promise you life in heaven with 40 women, that seems like a pretty good alternative to what the current life is now.
And you get more if you're a suicide bomber.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's the age-old trick of using vulnerable people to do your bidding by promising something in the afterlife. The same thing in the Crusades on the Christian side, and right, vice versa. And so it's a terrible problem. And even if we just talk about Hamas and Israel, because the two-state solution that's been talked about, how can there be two states when far greater educational indoctrination than what the Islamic State is doing has been done in the Gaza Strip for decades? How can you have two coexisting states, right, if you don't address that issue? And that's not on the table for negotiation. How can Israel expect it to live next to a country like that?
Yeah, I mean, can you promise to stop hating us? Sure, you know, we'll sign the paper. It doesn't change that quickly. And it's not about space or just wanting our own little spot. It's not about that. It's about destroying the other group.
Yeah.
You can't ever come to peace that way. I mean, we're almost starting to see that in the U.S. too, where it's a two-state solution, right? Liberals and conservatives, two states,
yeah,
living together, but kind of hating each other. It's not to that level yet, thankfully, but we're pretty divided over here too.
Yeah, well, that's what happened during the Civil War. It was two distinct societies, the North and the South, that developed, and they couldn't coexist anymore, so they fought. And that's the same with it happens in any society if we allow it to go that far. And that's exactly what's going to happen in all these other countries too. If not all immigrants are like this. It's probably the minority, but still, can you risk that? The well-being of your country, the safety of your own children. What's the value? It's a hard question to answer. It's hard to be fair and that sort of thing, but someone has to make the decision, and it's something that innocent lives are at stake. So it is a hard issue to broach, but someone has to make a tough decision, and they have to stick by it in order to be effective.
Yeah, in that book, Captive by Jerry Van Dyke, they vetted him when they caught him. They knew everything about him. They found out everything about him. They found out where he lived. They found out who he knew, the people that captured him, the terrorists. shouldn't we do the same thing? Find, you know, when people are coming in, find out about them.
Yeah.
They do. They'll certainly find out all about you. And so that's all that I think most level-headed people want. Just at least vet and find out where somebody's coming from. What are they doing?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm a immigrant into this country. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm from Canada, so it wasn't as rigorous as probably other people have to go through, but it still was a rigorous process that I didn't know everything, what I was doing. I have to be forthright and honest at where I'm going, what I'm doing when I come and go out of the United States. And it can be a very expensive process as well. So, but the benefits outweigh all those small things. I mean, to be vetted, look at the benefits you get in return. Living in the most prosperous society in human history. I mean, that's a small price to pay for being able to escape from those terrible areas.
Yeah, I mean, the only people that don't want to be vetted are those that have something to hide. You know, if it's just a matter of looking into your past. I mean, nobody probably loves it, but at the same time, if you're not hiding anything, and it's part of the process, that's kind of, you know, like you said, the benefits outweigh the whatever, I don't know, inconvenience.
Yeah,
there would be.
Yeah,
and so it's an ongoing debate with immigration, but this story really highlights why you do have to pay attention to who's coming in, because there's all kinds of thinking out there. Foreignpolicy.com, J is for Jihad, How the Islamic State Indoctrinates Children with Math, Grammar, Tanks, and Guns. Pretty interesting story. You can read the rest of that there. That's all that time we have today on Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Trumpet Hour Week in Review also. And stop and check out the Trumpet.com headlines. If you missed anything this week, you can find that at thetrumpet.com. For myself, Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondeau, and Grant Turgeon, thanks for spending some time with us this week and today, this weekend on Trumpet Radio Live. Have a great weekend. Enjoy yourself. Be safe. See you back here on Monday.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.